Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the DIY Creative Podcast. Me, Senator Jez, friends call me Aben. You can call me Aben. And we have a treat today. We have an artist that is based out of New York City today. We have Nino Bedarin, also known as the Submariner.
Yes, sir.
Something we're going to have to get into. Nino, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure. My manager was actually the one who put me onto your podcast, and I love what you're doing. I listened to a few episodes, and it was so refreshing to see with, you know, so many podcasts out there. There's only so few that really talk about music and everything that goes behind being a creative. Knowing you're a creative yourself, I'm excited for this conversation.
This is going to be great. This is going to be great. Now, before we get too deep into this, it has to be said, you have new music coming out on Friday. Absolutely. Which would be the 22nd. I mean, no telling when somebody's going to listen to this, right?
So exactly. Yeah, who knows? I mean, some people could listen to it a year from now. Yeah, so we are 2021. I have new music coming out this Friday, January 22nd. The new single is called Sully My Name. It's a blend between hip hop, a little bit of pop, and even some pop urban vibes. And I'm excited for that. Hopefully the people like it when it comes out. It's going to be available everywhere.
Would you mind if I played a little snippet of it right here just to give
people
a taste?
Please, absolutely. Go ahead, absolutely.
In vain of you being blood, you did it again. All these failed attempts to discredit my name. With everything to lose, nothing to gain, you would still jump at any chance to sully my name. You wanna see me down, out, down. You wanna spin me round, round, round. Truth I faced it, You wanna see me down, out, down. You wanna spin me round, round.
That's awesome, man. I love that. That has
Thank
such
you.
A vibe to it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the music I've been making lately was really centered around emotion. And, you know, in that particular track, there's really emotive chord progressions, a mix of, you know, minor chords and major chords as well, which make you feel particularly strongly. The lyrics are also based on, like, you know, my story. And that song centers around, you know, when people try to discredit everything you've done for yourself, just kind of showing them that regardless of what they say, any attempt for them to sully your name, it won't go through, or it will fall short. So that record is particularly personal and real for me. And I love that record. I'm excited for when it comes out this Friday.
Well, I am too. And that's some powerful stuff, because really when you're a creative, you have your art and you have your name.
Yep.
And
exactly.
One thing. Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I don't get anymore is in this day and age where you can be an independent, you can get your music out, you can get any of your art out, why people think this is still such a competition? Because
true.
Somebody else putting something out or going at you, whatever they're doing doesn't affect you any longer, or me any longer, or
exactly.
them any longer. But some people will go at you. So that's very powerful stuff. I like the theme of that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, it almost feels like a lonely road sometimes. But the thing is, with art, it's all about finding yourself in it. And that's when you really become the best version of yourself, because we all take inspiration from a lot of great artists that have came before us. But once you find yourself in the art, you almost realize it's almost like a self-actualization process. That's why I think, you know, art is sometimes some of the most powerful way to grow and become, you know, the best version of yourself and who you really want to be, because you face your flaws and you realize, okay, I'm not good at this, that, or the third, but I have intentions of getting better. And you also realize what you are good at and what you do bring to the table. So it almost humbles you, but also gives you a reason to keep and to want to get better at, you know, making music, but also become a better person. So that's why I essentially fell in love with music.
Yeah, it's a tightrope, isn't it? Because you have to really love what you're doing, but then you have to, in a way, be able to take what people say about what you're doing. But 100%. On that same note, I don't think that I don't like the term average person, but here it fits. The average person, let's call them the civilians, the non-musicians, the non-artists. I don't know that they understand just how hard it is. you get better with it over time. But at first, they don't understand what it is to put your heart and soul into art and then share it. Because that's the scariest thing at first. And people can be so mean. And they, you know, the offhanded comments. But I really like now that people can get their art out. But that's one thing that I like to do with this show. I want people to know that you got to share what you do. Because, you know, 1,000 people, 1,500 people, 1,000,000 people may hate what you're doing, but you're looking for that one person that gets it. And that one person will bring another person and another person. But it's 100%. Scary at first, man. It's scary at
first. It is. For example, I'll refer back to my biggest single, which is currently sitting at 3,000 plays around.
Congrats.
That was, thank you. That was a single I was really scared of putting out because I'd never made music like that. So the single I'm referring to is Lifeless. And in that particular single, it's almost, I wouldn't say a depressive single, but it's definitely a single that's based on reality. I talk about my upbringings and my difficult past, right? Being faced with traumatic experiences, you know, living in impoverished communities and things like that. So I knew I had never made music like that before. I was more so making feel good music that was melodic, but I really rolled the dice on that single and I expected people not to like it. And during the first month, nobody really gravitated towards it too much. But then it got picked up by this promotional YouTube channel, which had 2.5 million subscribers. And they posted the song and people loved it. But the fact that I even took that risk and accepted the fact that maybe people wouldn't like it at all to begin with, and the fact that I had the courage to even put it out there, to put a part of myself out there, you know, it's scary. People don't realize it until they have to experience it themselves. You know, that's why, you know, when people critique art, you always have to take it with some sort of grain of salt because it's coming from a consumer standpoint. But there is also a lot of value in their input because they can give you suggestions and how it made them feel. But a creative can give you insight on, you know, the techniques that you need to improve on. So there's always value in critique, but also knowing, you know, what people say is always subjective and it doesn't determine you. And as long as you're willing to take that risk, as long as you're willing to put yourself out there, you've won in a certain capacity. Even if you have one fan, the fact that one person gravitates towards your work and finds value in it and is able to return to it, that's something powerful because not a lot of people get that opportunity or even have the courage in it. That doesn't make them cowardly. It just makes them, you know, human, right? That sense of fear.
Well, one thing that kind of worries me about the independent scene right now is the fact that anybody can put their stuff out. And I just know from the local scene here, I've got a tough skin. I mean, you could brush me along the concrete. You're not going to penetrate. I've been at this so long. But some people in the local scene here, I've tried to get them to do that, to share their work, but they're very sensitive. A lot of artists are sensitive, and we're all sensitive. Just like I say, some of us have put a shell on, or we're building a shell.
Right.
And whenever I see somebody attacking, here's the thing: you never know how vulnerable that person really is.
100%.
You don't know what the value they're putting on what they've put out.
Yeah.
Like I put out music and if people don't like it, I'm like, well, maybe they'll like the next one. Bah.
Yeah.
But some people, they really wrap themselves up in it. So right. I feel kind of fatherly toward those guys, you know, but, but the thing is everybody has an opinion these days and people just love sharing it. But I love the fact that you're getting your stuff out there. One thing that I wanted to touch on is, being that your stuff is rap based, although like you say, there's R&B in there, man. You pull from diversity, from diverse genres in there, and you are keeping it real. But you're keeping it real in a way that's not what's the word I'm looking for? Because I want to make sure that I get the right word. it's not caustic.
Mm-hmm.
It's real, but I actually can feel sometimes there's a shock value that people want. When people say they want to keep it real, they go straight for shock value.
True.
I didn't get that in your stuff. I got a smoothness to it, you know?
Yeah. That's a great point. Because when you are creative, I'll refer back to my earlier stuff. So it took me three and a half years to get to this point. And I think this is the only point beginning last year, 2020, was when I was really beginning to feel that I was connecting with my art on a way different level. And people were gravitating towards it really differently. People were really surprised at how the control over my voice had changed over the years, my lyrical content, and the production that went with it. But when I was making music for those first 3 years, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no control over anything. But that feeling of even just putting anything out there, knowing it's not that great, I was kind of always on the fence about every release, but I knew that if I kept at it, there would be a point where maybe I wouldn't reach mainstream success or even underground success, but even if I touch a few people, it would feel real. And I always battled with, you know, my writing over the years, because early on, you don't have any control over how to write, how to find your own writing style, and what kind of thematics you want to address, because there's always this fight between telling too much and not telling enough. Because if you tell too much, you're kind of jeopardizing your own privacy. But if you don't tell enough, people may not be able to relate to it at the level that you want them to. So for me, it was an ongoing battle over the years of trying to tell my story in a way that didn't sound too cliche, in a way that, you know, it didn't sound like a story somebody had ever told, because, you know, some of the best stories, they have underlying similar thematics that have always been addressed in art over time. But you have to find that balance almost between giving people that shock value, that new insight into who you are, without it sounding too like trying to grab attention. And when you do that, it almost feels like it's an attempt at grabbing attention, but it doesn't come from an authentic place. It doesn't come from a place where you're really trying to tell your story. More so comes from a place where you're trying to just get the listener's ear. And people can feel that. People can feel authenticity in art. And that's why there's so much value in critique from the consumer, from the listener. But yeah, I mean, even with this newest single, I was having trouble writing the verses, where I was trying to see how much am I going to tell about, you know, people trying to sully my name, right? I touched on courage and how people tried to say, because of my calm demeanor, some people almost perceive it as me being cowardly, but it's not exactly the case. And trying to tell my story in a way that's detailed enough for people to get a clear picture and for it to be an enticing story, but also not telling, you know, the most absurd things people have said about me, so people don't see it as like me trying to get attention or me trying to create this shock value around the record. So it is really difficult, and art is just about finding that fine balance. But yeah, I mean, I battled with it over the years. My earlier work, sometimes I, you know, there were a few questionable lines where I was saying things that weren't 100% authentic to me, but I see myself as the years go on, and especially this year, you know, continuing to find that great balance between telling my story, but, and it having resonating with people, but it not being, you know, an attempt to just shock people and kind of gain notoriety over that. Because, you know, with that, people will expect you to make more things like that, but it's hard to replicate certain things that don't feel authentic. So yeah, I mean, that was a great question. Yeah.
Well, actually, anybody that's listening or watching this podcast right now, go back and listen to that again, because there were so many nuggets in there. I'm going to try to unpack just a couple of them right here. Mm-hmm. I think it was before we actually got, before we started recording, you mentioned that being an independent, you're an entrepreneur as well as an artist.
Right.
So what I just heard there was just nuggets, that truth nuggets all over the place right there. And it's a marathon, not a sprint. 100%. That's for one thing. One thing that really nails the independence is they come out, they put something out, and they either expect the world to beat a path to their doorway, or they're like, well, it didn't work. What now? Well, mm-hmm. you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you don't get discouraged, and you keep doing it. I think too many kids these days watch the contest shows, mm-hmm. and they think that's how you do it. Not realizing that what you're doing in that situation is you're selling your soul to somebody that's going to put money up to let you record, but they're going to bring in right. a team of writers, and they're going to put an algorithm to it just so that the right chords and the right melodies, and mm-hmm. it's not you. Authenticity when you're an independent is a really big thing. You touched on that. And the big one is, and this is something I stress in a lot of these shows, is when you're an independent, success is whatever you frame it as.
Right.
It doesn't matter if your best friend's mom has heard you on the radio. You know, you can make money without anybody knowing who you are.
Right.
You could go write music for a museum. You could, nobody knows. Yeah. You can.
But yeah, that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. You set your goal, and then you work toward your goal, and it's a marathon, not a sprint. There was a lot of truth in there. And you did touch on other things too, with your authenticity. As much as you're comfortable, why don't you tell us your story of how you got to where you are now?
Right, you know. Absolutely. So first, here's how I got into music. So I was in third grade, and I was casually listening to what my parents were, you know, playing in the house. I have a French background, a French Caribbean background. So it was a lot of, you know, ethnic music, kind of island dance hall, French music as well. But I never really got into American music. At the time, I was barely learning English. I was still in third grade. I was beginning to get acquainted with New York life. But it still felt like I was almost a stranger in New York. So at the school I went to, there were a lot of great musicians. I mean, we were all in third grade, but what they were doing at the time seemed like incredible. And a lot of people were playing the piano. And in my particular homeroom, there was a piano. And I always saw people playing the piano. I loved how it sounded. I loved the reactions that, you know, people had after hearing someone play, you know, beautiful piece. I mean, it was third grade, so nobody was really playing any crazy Mozart or anything like that. But, you know, it was just the fact that people had this hobby, and it was music, and it felt so personal. And just that connection you have with an instrument is so beautiful. So I began to play the piano. We couldn't afford any piano classes. We were new to New York City, so it's not like we had the money for it or renew people for it. So I got on YouTube. I mean, as a kid, it's crazy to think that now young people have so much access to the internet and phones. But even as a kid, I was born in 2000. In third grade, I was what, 8? And I had access to a telephone. I had access to a computer. Granted, it wasn't the best computer. I started going on YouTube, looking up, you know, how to play the piano. I didn't know anything. The first song I learned was Rihanna, Unfaithful. And I remember watching the tutorials every day until I got the song down. And surprisingly, I got the song down in 2 weeks. And I showed up to my homeroom that next week, and I played the song. And my teacher was so impressed. And everybody else was like, whoa, this is a song we've never heard before, because that is more of an R&B song. And everybody at the time was playing, you know, more like classical music and things like that. So my teacher was impressed, and he told me to sign up for a recital. I had never played at a recital. I'd never been on stage. And I figured, sure, why not? I know this song inside out. So I show up to the recital, I play it. And the thing was, I'm a short guy. I'm not super tall, But as a kid, I was even shorter, and I had trouble like reaching the stool to sit on the piano and reaching the keys. So as I was playing the song during the recital, I was slowly backing away from the keys. So there was a point where I stood up because I didn't want to stop mid-song or mess up. And then people seemed to be impressed. For me, it seemed normal. And then there was a standing ovation. I finished the song. I got off stage, and so many teachers, so many people went up to my parents saying, wow, this guy seems like a prodigy. I wasn't a prodigy. I was just someone who set my heart out to do something, and I did it until I kind of mastered it or knew it really well. And so they were recommending me, you know, piano teachers from my school. And they had told me, you know, if he keeps up like this, he could be an incredible musician. So I continued to play the piano for years. And the thing was, when it comes to a passion, when people begin to put pressure on you, it almost feels like you lose touch with it, or it feels like a chore instead of, you know, genuine love for what you're doing. So my parents, you know, they were aware of the positive reception that had come with, you know, my performance and how so many people were believing in me and were calling me a prodigy. I wasn't anything close to that, because really a prodigy is a different level. But they were aware that I did have a gift. I could learn songs by just listening to them. And when you have that kind of a skill, or that you garner at such a young age, it's valuable to capitalize off it and see where it takes you. But the fact that they were telling me every day to play 1 or 2 hours a day, you know, I was beginning to grow up. You know, you go through a slightly rebellious phase where you don't want to do what your parents tell you. I began to lose touch with the piano. I began to play less and less. And came seventh grade, I wanted to stand my ground and go against my parents. And so I stopped playing the piano for a couple of years. Then I was listening to other people play the piano. I was getting more into music in general, different kinds of music, not just hip hop, R&B, rock, a little bit of soul, a little bit of neoclassic, jazz especially. And I was beginning to miss, you know, just having my hands on the black and white keys. And I figured, you know, my parents understood my point. They weren't forcing me to play the piano. Say if I ever wanted to, I could go back to it. I went back to it around, I don't know, maybe ninth grade, went back to it, played sparingly, and realized, you know, this is something I love. But at the time, I was really into hip hop. So I had this kind of like idea, oh, I knew every lyric to every Drake song. I knew every lyric to every Kendrick Lamar song. And I would always rap it out loud every time a song came on. And I would rap it around friends. And they were like, yo, this is so good. How do you know the lyrics? And I was like, you know, I just looked them up online and learned the song. Then I love these songs. And, you know, with people always being excited when we played music and when I would rap over it, I always thought to myself, oh, what they're doing is so easy. I could totally do what they're doing. And so this joke went around my high school. And I kept telling people every time a hip hop song came on and I could rap it, oh yeah, I have a mixtape coming soon. I could totally be a rapper. But at that point, it was always a joke, because I knew that if I wanted to do music, it would always be, you know, just more like a hobby, and it would be playing instruments, not really making my own songs. I didn't know how to make any songs. I didn't know anyone in the music industry. So that joke ran along until 10th grade. And it was a funny joke, but then there were people actually wondering, wait, are you actually working on anything music related? And there was a point where someone asked me seriously, are you actually going to make a mixtape? And I figured, you know what? Why not? Let's just try it. So I went home that day, and I remember I was watching a lot of how to rap videos, because there's this rap coach on YouTube. I was watching a lot of how to have good delivery or good voice. And then I just pulled up a bunch of instrumentals on YouTube and just started rapping over them. Now, granted, a lot of my earlier work was heavily inspired by Kendrick Lamar, Drake. So I used to reference their lines that they used in their music a lot. But I didn't really know what I was doing at all. but I released my first song early 2017. And just the fact that I put something out there and people saw that, you know, this whole mixtape thing might not have been a joke, they were surprised. So the end product wasn't that great, but the fact that they saw I was putting something out there and that nobody else was really doing this, I mean, this was unheard of. People were surprised, but they also listened to it a little bit. It didn't go crazy or anything, absolutely not. I mean, I garnered maybe a couple hundred plays. And so I kept doing it because I was like, whoa, this is fun. I got into beat making because the thing was, you know, people were telling me, oh, you could make money off your music. But I didn't know how. I didn't know how that entailed. But I was beginning to familiarize myself with the business side of music, right? Once you start to make it, you got to get familiar with how it works and everything. I was beginning to learn that, you know, you have to buy beats. I didn't have any money to buy beats. I was a kid, first of all, and we were broke. So I knew that was out the door. So I figured, why don't I learn how to make beats? I mean, I'm already on this DAW. Let me maximize it to its fullest potential and see what I can make out of it. I started making beats. I watched a lot of YouTube channels. There's so much on YouTube. You can practically learn anything on YouTube. Started making beats and, you know, years went by. I released a lot of really bad singles. I graduated high school. And that summer I was going into university. I go to the University of Virginia. And I was going into it studying business. And I knew I wanted to do business. But in my head, I was beginning to realize if there's ever an opportunity with music, I'll try to capitalize off it. But let me also go down this avenue of, you know, finishing school because it's so valuable. And I've always been great at school and I always saw the value in school really early on. So I figured, let me try and see if I can kill two birds in one stone. If something happens with music, great. If not, I still have business, which I'm still really into. First year of college goes pretty good. And I'm just making a lot more music. I realize that I'm getting better. Some people are even buying my singles. I mean, one person bought one single I had released during my first year of college. And I was like, whoa, the fact that even one person bought it means like I'm doing something good or I'm getting better. I continued to make music. And then second year of university came, 2020 came, and I was beginning to get so much better. You know, the control over my voice, more diverse production, more in tune and personalized writing and storytelling, control over my pen. And that's when I realized I really want to do this. So, you know, I decided to stop my business major. I decided to major in music. And I was kind of against it. My mom was not really against it, actually. She was surprised, but she knew that over the years, I was beginning to realize that if I really want to live a life that's truly beautiful, sometimes there's going to be a point where I'm going to have to jeopardize the stability of doing something, you know, like business. There's a lot of stability. There's not a lot of risk because there's a lot of opportunity. There's a huge market and demand for, you know, marketers, for financial analysts. So that would have been the safer route. But if you want to truly get happiness out of your life, taking a risk and doing what you love, which has more risk in it, I was beginning to fall in line with that idea. Maybe I should take a risk on this. So I declared a major in music. And, you know, still to this day, sometimes I think, you know, will it pay off? Who knows? I'm still maximizing all of my chances in music. And, you know, 2020 came, I released a couple great singles. End of the year was when I was really beginning to up my stats. I got that huge promotion from Promoting Sounds. I got written up by a couple of articles. I got posted to a lot of great music, Instagram blogs, and, you know, curators. And people were gravitating towards my work a lot. And that's when my manager reached out to me and he said, well, the music you're making right now is absolutely incredible. This was end of November 2020. So everything has, to this point, has been really quick. He said, and this was my manager, actually, fun fact, was the one that I went to school with. And he was the one who actually got me to play the piano in the first place in third grade, because I saw him play the piano and I was so amazed. And, you know, we had known each other, and he was working on music business at his school at USC. And he said, I see so much potential in you. I believe in your music. I think it's amazing. And I really think that, you know, based on my experiences working at, you know, doing internships in certain record labels, I think that if we combined both our heads, you, the creative, and me, you know, with my expertise and kind of the skills I've learned over the years working in the music business, I think we can make something happen and show the world exactly what you have to bring to it. And which has led us to this point, which actually led us to this interview.
Well, you know, it's there's a guy on YouTube. He's a guitarist. He's a his name's Rhett Schull. And his big thing is no plan B. Mm-hmm. And what your story there is, and this is, I truly believe this. Some people have different names for it, but when you signal your intention and you throw all of your belief behind it, you'll find that doors are starting to open and you don't know how they opened. You don't know how the opportunity got thrown in front of you. Whenever you're working on that plan B, you're not putting all of your intention into the thing that you're trying to accomplish.
Very true.
People are really scared, so they want to have that fallback. And what I don't think what people get is there's always going to be a fallback. Mm-hmm. If something really doesn't work out, well, then plan B will present itself. You know, I mean, you just have to shift gears. But when you throw all of your intention and all of your belief behind yourself, and you're putting out the positivity, you're putting out the positive energy, positive comes back at you. And like I say, okay, so you knew the guy from the third grade. He's the guy that got you to start playing the piano. Suddenly the universe is spinning here, you know, and you throw yourself into music instead of business. And, you know, sometimes a belief in yourself is the main thing, a belief in yourself, your talents. One thing that I pick up is what I find is really healthy in your attitude. And I'm not trying to be condescending. I'm not trying to be 51-year-old dude telling you anything.
Don't worry.
Is
not
that
a problem.
I find some people that are really confident and they boast. And then I find some people who are really talented, but they're meek. You've kind of have that nice, you're right where you need to be. You have no problem talking about your talents and what you do and how you do it, but there's a humbleness behind it as well. And that's hearkening back to the authenticity you were talking about earlier that I find. It's either somebody really can brag, but they can't necessarily back it up, or somebody's really good at something, but they can't bring themselves to talk about it. Right. In this modern world we're in right now, and I'm sure you've come up against this before, people want to say that they're supporting you, but they don't want to hear anything that you're doing, because I get marketed to all the time, or if you made good art, then you wouldn't have to act that way. And it sort of gets you to that point, like, well, how do I get my name out there? You've got people out there, you're like, well, will you buy my stuff? I don't buy music. Okay, will you tell people about my music? I'm busy. Will you do anything, you know? And it's like, you're at this point and you're like, but you got to be able to talk about yourself. You have to be able to talk your music, and you do that very well.
100%. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, it's a difficult thing to juggle. You know, I think my process has actually been over the years, you know, I used to be very meek, you know, when I started making music, I always compared myself to so many other great artists. And, you know, that it's so dangerous, but it's so common. I mean, you need a point of reference to see what you want to build on, because in music, you can't just create something entirely new. Music, even the newest music and the most innovative music nowadays, is some sort of different rendition of what's already been done. So you do need to compare yourself, and you do need to give other people who have never heard you, a point of reference so they can go into it with either a positive attitude or at least know what to expect. But when you begin to compare yourself, it's the struggle of a creative.
Comparison, you lose is yourself. So, yeah, comparison, yeah, is so. And here's the thing: you never know what's on the other side that you're comparing yourself to.
Yeah.
Oh man, I want to say it was a couple of years ago, maybe even sooner. I don't know. And I think it was, is it Little Bow Wow?
Rapper, oh, Bow Wow, yes.
Yeah, and yep, he did a selfie in front of a private jet.
Oh, I saw.
And then
that.
Somebody caught him in economy on the actual, exactly, plane he was flying. Yep. He wasn't on that private jet.
Yeah.
But how many times does that happen? And you're comparing yourself to this person. You can rent luxury cars, and mm-hmm, as long as you don't get the license plate, you can take your pictures in front of them. There was an ad where this lady's in what looks like a private jet, and she gets up and she's talking about how to make it. And it turns out that this was just a fuselage in a hangar, and she walks out of it. And she was giving up the ruse there. You know, it's like she wasn't trying to get anybody. She was kind of showing how you can fake it so easily these days. And on social media, it can be so toxic because you're thinking, I have my little life here. I'm trying to make my music. And look at this person. They're doing this, 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 and this. And but what they're not doing is you. Yeah. Only you can do you.
Only you can do you. I mean, that's correct. You never know when it comes to artistry, you never know what kind of resources other people have access to, which allows them to have such great music. I mean, if we all had access to great equipment, great engineers, all of our music could compete with a lot of these bigger acts. But, you know, it's the struggle of a young independent artist, but you make of it what you get. People will still be able to find value in it. So it's once you begin to detach yourself from this comparison, because the comparison can only lead you down a bad path, can only lead you to self-doubt. There's never anything good that comes from it. Even if you're comparing yourself to see if you can compete with other people, the final conclusion is always going to be, no, I can't, because you don't have the resources, because you don't have that fan base, because you don't have the connections or the equipment. So it's never healthy, and it never leads to anything. But I learned that the hard way. I mean, I think every creative has to learn it the hard way. But sometimes it's disheartening. And that's where, you know, a lot of creatives, they decide to quit. They decide to, you know, lose their path, lose the focus, because sometimes those negative thoughts are so overpowering. I mean, I've experienced it myself. I've way too many times I've experienced wanting to quit, you know, and thinking, you know, maybe my life would be better if I never took this chance. But in reality, I know how much value music brings to me. I know that I have things I want to say. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, personal relations, I'm not someone who's very, very outgoing or very talkative. I keep to myself. So music for me is my outlet, almost a therapy for me to voice my pain, for me to voice what's on my mind. And, you know, if I decided to remove it from my life and music indefinitely, I don't think it would do me any good. Even though there is this crippling self-doubt that builds up and it comes and goes, the thing is, it's not a phase. It's chronic. It follows you. Just always being able to remain grounded, to acknowledge what you've achieved so far, and be grateful, because I know myself that I don't have like hundreds of thousands of followers. I don't even have 1,000 followers, but I knew compared to when I first started, I was begging myself. I was begging God. I was begging the universe to put me in the position I am right now. So, you know, I always make sure I keep my mental in check. A lot of music is talent and opportunity, but for longevity, it is always a mindset thing. It is always a mental thing. So that's always something that, you know, people kind of throw to the side, keeping your mental health in check. And I mean, we're seeing it with the pandemic, you know, having a healthy mental state, and you know, making sure you're keeping those negative thoughts under control and keeping the positive ones at the forefront, and always remaining humble, or even just seeing the good and even like really bad situations. Yeah. I know for me, that's something that's helped me a lot.
Well, you know, gratitude actually puts you in a position to accept things into your life rather than putting up a wall, keeping things out of your life. And you mentioned gratitude. I talked earlier about, you know, that one fan. And I don't mean you should be like, I got one fan, I'm taking over the world. What I mean is never neglect that one fan. Never.
100%.
I don't generally do the whole drama online thing, but I listen to a couple of shows like Philip DeFranco or something, and he talks about the internet drama things. And I guess there's a girl, is it the D'Amelio sisters or what have you? And recently they were having a dinner and they were making fun of the chef or something. And James Charles there, who is I believe he's a beauty YouTuber influencer. Or something, influencer. Yeah. And she was like, she has like 900 and something thousand people that follow her. And she wanted to be the first one to a million. And she was complaining that she wasn't at a million. And James Charles very, very maturely says basically what we're talking about here. You know, 995,000 isn't enough for you. And she's like, oh, I just wanted to be a million. I'm like, every one of those 995,000 should have dumped her right there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Because I mean, like, how, and this is me kind of going against what I say, I'm bringing negativity into this, but I guess it's just like, you can't ever get to the point where you just expect people are going to be there for you. You have to nourish those that are there for you. You got to show them gratitude and then let them carry you.
To
the next level. So that's the whole thing behind a one fan. You know, be good to your one fan.
Absolutely.
It's been shown that you can make a career with 1,000 true fans.
Yeah.
1,000 people that will consume your product, that will buy your merchandise. You can live very well off that. Now, we all want more than that.
Absolutely.
It'd be silly to say, I got my 1,000. I'm checking out. No more marketing. I got, you know, no. That's not what we're saying. But you've got to appreciate, and you, like you say, you do. You've got to appreciate the ones that are there. And the ones that are there early are going to be the ones that are going to be your most rabid fans 100%. Later.
It's funny you say that, because the people I went to high school with, a lot of them still support my music now. But the thing is, they support my music now because they always have, but they support it even more because they recognize the hard work I put into it. They recognize all the conversations I've had about them with music, about music. And sometimes they weren't able to relate. Sometimes they were able to. Sometimes it was them giving me constructive criticism. Sometimes, you know, it was, you know, them supporting me and telling me, yo, you're getting better. But the fact that they were there from the start, and back when I had no idea what I was making with music, and you can probably find the music online and listen to it for yourself. It's absolutely nothing that great. I look back on it as, you know, if an industry executive or someone who's been a musician for a long time were to see, you know, my first few songs or even my first 10 songs, they would think there's no hope. But of course, you know, I say that because, you know, I can look back at my past and laugh at this. And even though I do, I still am so thankful for those first few songs, because that's what led me here. But yeah, I mean, looking back, they would have said, okay, there's no hope for this guy. He has no understanding of what musicality is. He's just adding a bunch of auto tune to, you know, muddy vocals that are not performed well. He doesn't even know what he's saying. But the fact that there were people at my high school that were supporting me, even though they've heard great music themselves, they know what they really like. But the fact that they went into it trying to find something good in it, and in the end, you know, sometimes there was a party and they would end up playing my song. And of course, there was a mood shift because you were playing some crazy mainstream song before, and then you end up playing my song, which it doesn't 100% match up, but that's besides the point. The fact that they even played it, I was so grateful at the time, because I knew I had a long way to go, but it just felt so real. It just felt so nice, and it was so heartwarming, right? You know, when people don't gravitate towards your work, the fact that they respect your hustle, the fact that they respect the amount of care that goes into it, it feels good, and you have to appreciate those people. And here I am, you know, still connected with those people, and they support me even more now because they realize how much better I'm doing. And, you know, I tell them regularly, you know, if it wasn't for you guys, I don't know where I would be. And the fact that, you know, you kind of interact with the fans, it makes them want to support you even more, right? Yeah. So, you know, of course, if you get really big and you have millions of fans, it's harder to interact with them individually. But those early fans, they can become the ones that push you on Twitter and write articles about you saying how you are the newest great young voice in so-and-so genre. If you show that love back to them, they will feel like they're being valued. They will feel like they're a part of the process. And when they're a part of that, they will literally second-handedly become a part of your marketing team, right? There's so many marketing efforts that go down, but some of the most valuable is social media posts about your music. And if you treat people, you know, your fans, even the first few ones, with that same respect they hold you to, you can both get something great out of that relationship and build something truly amazing.
Yeah, well, there's two things that I think that people starting out don't get. And you're hitting on those right now. And first is, when you start something, you suck.
Yeah.
Every one of us, nobody. What's the thing people say all the time? You know, if a baby tried to walk and fell down, and you know, if it, you get it up and you make it try again. If you just said, "Oh well, you just failed at walking,"
you're not walking.
That's not how it works. Yeah,
exactly.
Everybody starts out bad.
Yep.
And the internet really is really good at masking the fact that you do start out bad, and that's perfectly fine. That's okay. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's just the way it is. And you never know. The other thing is you never know what's going to blow up.
Yep.
So 100%. You got to always be respectful to everybody that follows you, because you never know when a post by somebody else or a mention here. It's so funny because, it still happens, but when the internet was kind of young, it would happen where somebody would go, it wasn't called viral at the time, but somebody would get really popular at something or else. And instead of keeping doing that, they would instantly go to try to sell people courses on how to do exactly what they did when they had no idea what they did.
Absolutely.
They have absolutely no idea what made them blow up. And it was obvious as it went on that, you know, they shifted from doing what they love, which worked, to trying to tell people how to do it. And it still happens a little bit.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
You never know when things are going to blow up.
Yeah. I mean, you can put in so much effort into a marketing tactic and it not work. Not because the tactics you're using are not good, not because that particular song is not good. It's just, you can't tell your audience. For example, I think a good example, if we were talking mainstream, for example, Drake, he tried to release this kind of TikTok trendy song. It was called Toosie Slide. But he did it with the intention of it going number one and it being, you know, the most played song on TikTok. I think, you know, I can't speak for someone's intentions, but the music felt that way. It seemed different than what he was more useful to or what his pocket was. And it did well. Of course, it is Drake. He is one of the best artists in music right now, or the biggest, at least. But it went, and then it kind of faded away, which was unexpected for, you know, such a big figure like him, because usually he's always dominating the charts. But it seemed like people didn't gravitate towards it how he expected it or how he wanted it to. And this is no diss to him or anything like that. You know, it's just like, you know, you study receptions in a market. You study how what moves people and how it moves people, but you can't study why it moves people, because that's particularly personal. That all it has to do is be with the music. There's three things to great music. It's great writing, great production, and great, you know, mixing and ingenuity, as well as being experimental. But the thing is, to gauge those factors, what determines each one of them, it's so different. I mean, you hear a song as complex as something like Kendrick Lamar, which is critically acclaimed, but you can have, you know, a song that's just a feel-good song that doesn't have particularly, you know, intense or structured songwriting, but that people may gravitate towards even more. I mean, it always depends on an emotion. It always depends on how people are feeling at that particular time. And you can't control time. You can't control people's emotions. You can't control people's experiences, what may trigger them, what may make them feel good, bad. And when it comes to that, you just have to, you know, let the audience do its work, yeah. Right?
Well, I've always said that if you, just using me as an example, if you like something I did, then you're absolutely right. If you hate something I did, you're absolutely right, because that's your opinion, and your opinion 100%. Is, so there's no such thing as bad music. I say this all the time. People probably get tired of me saying it. There's only stuff you don't like.
Like,
100%. Unfortunately, people look at, I don't like that, thus it doesn't deserve to exist. I mean, we live in a world where Tekashi 6ix9ine is a thing.
Yeah.
I don't understand his music to save my life, but he has fans. He has fans now that he's come out of prison. I mean, wasn't it supposed to be the thing? He'd come out of prison and everybody would abandon him because he was a snitch. But no, but he's
still has a core
there.
Fan base.
Yeah. And it's not up to me to say that's wrong, because the people that like Tekashi 6ix9ine are correct. They do like his stuff. Would they listen to my stuff? Maybe. Depends how open-minded they are. But it's safe to say that I make something a universe separate from what Tekashi 6ix9ine does. You make stuff that's a universe separate, and technically you could say that you're in the same genre, sort of.
Exactly, yeah. You really could. And it almost feels like, you know, within the genre, there's always so many different things you can do. I mean, you never know what resonates with people. My biggest single was the single I was most reluctant on putting everywhere. And it was my biggest single. What I thought would be my biggest single, what I had the intention of making more mainstream sounding, which was the single right after, titled Jungle, it didn't do as well as the single before. And I had, not saying I was trying to make a hit, but I was definitely incorporating in the production elements you'd find in a lot of mainstream music, right? A heavy 808 bass line, with some really sharp and crispy hi-hats with a nice little bounce and a rim shot. And I mean, it's been done in mainstream. It's nothing too innovative, but it resonates with people. So I figured, you know, let me take a direction where I can add some mainstream elements to the song while not jeopardizing my own authenticity and my own sound. But people didn't gravitate towards it like that. I mean, I couldn't control it. I thought I could control it, but that's when I realized, you know, there is no such, you were right. There is no such thing as bad music. There is what you don't like, what you do like. And at the end of the day, if what you're making is what you love, that is always most important. I personally think I should never, and I will never jeopardize my own, love for some music over, you know, somebody else's, right? So if I want to put out a song and somebody's telling me not to, and I love the song, even if they have critiques of it and I want to release it, I will always release that particular song.
I made a big mistake last year in my marketing and in how I branded myself. And it's because of my distributor doesn't have a whole lot of genres that I could release in. Mm-hmm. I've changed distributors because of that, not because I didn't like what they did. They were great, but they couldn't pinpoint me where I needed to be. So I tried to rebrand myself last year. And when I say I made a big mistake, last year went fine. It's just what I put out. I put out two albums last year, and the one I was thinking, wow, this isn't going with my new branding at all and everything. Mm-hmm. That was the one everybody liked, because it was the one that was the kind of stuff I normally do. And the one that was along the line of the new branding, well, people didn't say they hated it, but nobody actually had any real emotion about it, you know? Right. So, yeah. You know, so it's along that line, but you did just touch on some things that I want to get at here. Now, for those that are thinking about being a producer, and especially the youngsters out there, which you are to me, but there are even younger folk than you out there. They're little whippersnappers all over the place.
100%. Yeah.
What are your studio tools? What are your weapons of choice?
Yeah, so we'll get into that. First, we'll talk about what I started with. So I actually started with a computer that was not mine. It was my oldest sister's. And the thing about that computer was I never had a computer. I only had like access to my parents' computers. So if I needed to do an assignment for school, it was on there. But knowing I wanted to get into music, I asked my sister if she was using her old laptop. And she said no. But the thing was that it wasn't her laptop. It was a laptop that she gotten from her university. So she went to Fordham University and she got it for free. And she gave it to me because at the time she had a MacBook. She was able to afford one. So I got that laptop. It wasn't a great laptop at all. It was very, very slow working on Windows 7, but I still made it work. Then I upgraded. I got a mic. It was a USB mic, you know. You always know as a creative, there's always these rites of passage and you have to go through the stages, the USB mic, then the entry level XLR, you know, then you can upgrade to the bigger interfaces, the bigger microphones. So I did the USB microphone for actually 3 years because I didn't have enough money to buy an interface and a microphone. And I didn't know exactly how it worked. But end of 2019, I bought a better USB microphone, which was the Samson G Pro. And that's actually what I recorded my biggest song on, ironically. And it's actually a really, really good USB microphone. But now I have a Focusrite interface connected to a Bluebird SL, which is a $300 mic, really nice microphone. And I'm thinking of going into probably this month, I'm planning on buying a new mic. A Neumann TLM 102, which is really, really great.
Yes.
But those are a bit more expensive. But I've been saving up because, you know, once you begin to feel more invested in your music, I don't feel as bad putting in more money in this equipment as I would have when I started, right, for example.
What's your DAW of choice?
FL Studio, but I love Ableton, for sure. Yeah. Ableton is really great for sample processing, and there's just so much you can do on Ableton that is not as ideal in FL Studio. I really think of sample processing. I really think of mixing as well on Ableton. Yeah. It's just a little superior to FL Studio. But FL Studio, since I was making beats and since I was making a lot of instrumentals, it was great. I still juggle around both. I've been just getting into Ableton, actually, but they're both great. I know I've used a little bit of Logic, really great for recording vocals. So, you know, mainly it is FL Studio. I've always recorded all of my songs in FL Studios, but when it comes to making samples, I've done a couple on Ableton, and these DAWs are becoming just state-of-the-art, unbelievable. I mean, I've been working with FL we're closing in on 4 years now, and there are still so many buttons, still so many plugins. I have absolutely no idea what they do. You know, I was just recently learning a sidechain trick, but sidechain was something I thought I had learned 3 years ago, but it turns out there's an easier way to do something. There's more complex plugins that do exact same thing that easier plugins don't. There's plugins that do, you know, reverb delay and slap delay all at once instead of bringing up three different, you know, mixing chains for it and then, you know, just connect. It's so bizarre.
Saving that processing power.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. It almost feels like that you can never really know a DAW 100%, but that's always the excitement. It's always like, oh, okay, can I do this quicker? So yeah, I mean, for example, I was learning about, you know, my mix buses, and, you know, turns out a lot of producers, they mix bus, they have mix buses for their drums, for their melodies, but I used to just mix it all at once. But, you know, sometimes depending on what you're trying to get out of a certain production, since mine is very hip hop inspired, there's huge emphasis on drums. There's a huge emphasis on, you know, really thick sounds and sounds that cut through the mix. They were saying, I think it was Alex Toomey, he was saying how having just a drum bus and mixing it down, you know, doing a little bit of compression, doing a little bit of dynamic control, it will bring up the, you know, what consumers would say, the volume of the drums, and make it stand out more and it clash less with the melody. But what these DAWs are capable of is absolutely insane for the price and for the amount of space they take up on your computer, what feels like nearly nothing.
Yeah, that is true, man. Technology is this is my old man moment, because I have to have an old man moment every time I have one of these, unless I'm talking to somebody about around my own age. It's one, I try not to get aggravated at the younger crowd, but whenever I hear somebody say that they can't make music because they don't have enough, or they don't have this, or they don't have that, I'm like, when I was a kid, we had nothing.
Yeah.
It's like, I was a kid when the Tascam 4-track cassette recorders came out, and those things were trash. They are treasured now because people use them in experimental ways and they get that lo-fi sound and stuff. But that wasn't something back in the 80s you could record on and then go to somebody and say, here's my stuff. No,
there was,
you know, if you didn't have access to a recording studio, you didn't get your stuff out. And even if you did have access to it, well, then how do you get it to the stores or anything? Because we didn't have Spotify and all that. So that's one of the things that kind of gets me. I'm like, no, you got more. Do you have an iPhone? If you have an iPhone, you can make you can make music, man.
100%.
You know, these days.
For example, I recently had heard this rumor that Kanye West had recorded a lot of his verses on his iPhone. That ended up on his Jesus is King album. Now, depending on what you think about that album, that doesn't matter. But the quality seemed almost studio-esque. So you can make the most out of the little material you had. I mean, my biggest song, which is sitting at nearly 300,000 on YouTube, which is crazy, and around 25,000 on Spotify, and a couple thousand, I think 5,000, closing in on 6,000 on SoundCloud. I made with a $100 USB mic, and I recorded it on a laptop I got from my university for free.
Yeah.
And listen, I mean, who would have thought I could get so many plays off basically nothing. I mean, this is what people would in the industry would consider scraps for material.
Listen to the gear snobs. And they'll tell you, you can't record on a USB mic. The gear snobs will tell you that all day long.
Yeah.
You
know,
but then you say, hey, gear snob, where's your music?
Exactly.
Yeah.
it'll give you a frequency spectrum. It'll say that, oh, in the 2000 range, there's a huge dip. That's why the quality in the USB microphone is not as good. Well, tell that to the 300,000 people who seem to find so much value in this music. I mean, I think if you have that kind of mentality, you're always going to be defeated. Even though, yes, it is super important to invest in yourself, and as you continue to make music, to want to have better gear, to want to put yourself in studio-like conditions so you can maximize what could be a great record and bring it to its fullest potential.
What people don't realize is that if you learn on cheaper gear and you can make good stuff on cheaper gear, as you get better and you get more gear, you know how to use it, because having all the best gear in the world is nowhere if you don't know how to use it.
100%.
You know, but when you start out on, I mean, everybody starts out again
somewhere.
When you start out, you suck, and generally you don't have the best gear, 100%. But you learn how to make that gear sound good. And then as you get better gear and you get better at your craft, man, you are right in the sweet zone. for creating. And that's not just 100%. Music. That's any art, you know? I mean, yeah. I don't have the good pencils. I just have the what is it? The 2B, whatever, the you know, school pencils. So,
yeah,
if you can draw with that, you know, then it goes across all disciplines. But Nino, we've been going quite a while. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, man.
Yeah. I just wanted say one thing. I think when you're starting off making music early on, you don't have the right, or you shouldn't have the focus on perfecting it, because I think with the flaws of the earlier music come this, you know, this when people go back to your earlier work and they see the flaws and they'll hear the progression, that will create another sense of authenticity. The fact that they will see the progression, they will hear that even though there is flawed music in his early catalog, he addressed those flaws and he had the intentions of getting better. So I think when you're first starting off, people have this mentality of trying to make it as perfect as possible, but just put something out there. That's mm-hmm. it.
That's it. Nino, man, we've been going at it quite a while. I want you to let people know how to find you and your stuff.
100%. So my name is Nino Bederan, NINOBEDERAN. And those are my Instagram handles, my Twitter handle. My email is NinoBederan, MGMT@gmail.com if you want to hit me up. And don't hesitate to follow me, Nino Bederan, on every platform, Spotify, Apple Music, SoundCloud, YouTube, anything, any platform that you use, Audio Mac. Go ahead and stream any singles if you're enticed. And I appreciate Senator Jazz for having me on the pod.
It's been a great conversation, but I've saved the one last question, the most important question of this entire interview. As a matter of fact, this whole interview rests on how good this question goes. It's that important.
That's
it's
a lot
that
of pressure.
Big. What about the Submariner?
What about the Submariner? Oh, we're going to touch into that. So it's actually funny because when I first rebranded, so I went by an old stage name. It was Max Prane. Not a great stage name. The music attached to it is not that great. If you end up finding some, you're going to have a nice little laugh, but it doesn't matter, right? So I rebranded, became Nino Bederan. And the thing behind the name is Nino, which is Nino in Spanish, means kid. It was, you know, a reference to my short stature, how I kind of look young. And Bederan was a play on words with better than, right? So I wanted this rebrand to be the kid better than he was before. And with that, I knew that was my stage name. But as I continued to make music for the first few months after my rebrand, I fell in love with this idea of the Submariner. So that originates from Marvel Comics and DC Comics, actually, with Black Panther, rest in peace to Chadwick Boseman. One of his biggest nemesis and one of his biggest foes is Namor the Submariner. And I've always loved the Black Panther. I've read so many of the comics, and I've kind of loved this love-hate relationship that he had with Atlantis and Namor. And I almost saw this rebrand as for a chance for me to be something bigger than me. So, you know, why not myself kind of rebrand as almost like this hero, not thinking that I am, but if I ended up making, it would almost be like a hero's story, the hero's arc, right? So I decided to incorporate it into, you know, kind of this alias I go by. So now it's either Nino Bederan or Nino the Submariner. I personally prefer the Submariner. And then the direct reference to DC is my love for Aqualad, who's sometimes called the Submariner. And he's kind of the protege in Atlantis behind Aquaman. And actually, funnily enough, I resonated with his story so much and his upbringing. And I actually dyed my hair blonde because of Aqualad, the Submariner.
There you go.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the story behind the Submariner.
Yeah. Well, you see, the interview was saved.
Perfect. Perfect.
See, it worked out. Nino, awesome. It's been really great having you on. Thank you for getting in touch. I think this is going to be a great episode. I think there's a lot of nuggets in here for those that need to hear what they need to hear.
100%. And
best of luck. Actually, no, screw that. Here's to a great release on Friday.
Thank you so much.
January 22nd, 2021, Sully My Name.
thank you for having me on the show. It was a great discussion, and wishing you the best. I'm going to keep supporting you because I love these podcast adventures you're on, and expect me as a daily supporter.
Much appreciated.
Thank you so much. Stay safe and stay blessed.
You too.